Welcome. We are honored to have you listen and participate in these dialogues produced by the Cora DeBrazza Foundation. To learn more about the foundation and about how you can help us in our mission of unearthing untold stories of moral energy, visit virtuesofpeace.com. There, you can access show archives, show resources, visit our Etsy shop, and support us with a donation. virtuesofpeace.com.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May, and today I'm joined by Michael Buzzy and Randy Olson. We are continuing today this discussion about the encounter between Olive Schreiner, a writer who dies in 1920, and Howard Thurman, theologian and philosopher who died in 1981. We talked about this last week, which was Peace Day. And we continue this conversation today, doing a little bit of a deeper dive into the moral psychology of the nonviolent way of life or the nonviolent lifestyle. As we began to discuss last week, the civil rights movement did, and I think people still do, make a distinction between nonviolence or pacifism as a tactic versus nonviolence or pacifism as a way of life. And we began last week to basically lay out the argument and the premises that this distinction can really be traced to Olive Schreiner, who Howard Thurman encounters when he is 25 years old and a student at Rochester Theological Seminary. At a conference, Olive Schreiner is read aloud to him. It changes his life in a way, and he has to read everything he can by her. And as I said, last week we talked about how this encounter really helps Thurman start to articulate this notion of the nonviolent way of life, which was later picked up by Martin Luther King. And we are continuing today to talk about what does that consist in, and specifically the moral psychology. If you're not familiar with that term, moral psychology, it is a term that you can find in philosophical ethics, and it really refers to put it most simply, the inner resources, as I like to say, so beliefs, desires, habits, addictions, the inner things going on that are relevant to moral behavior. So we're going to be unpacking the moral psychology of the nonviolent way of life today. There are a number of different clips. I think we're pulling from three or four of Howard Thurman's sermons, and you can access those sermons in their entirety on our Shore Resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. Listening to those sermons or talks is a really wonderful way to learn more about Howard Thurman. So just a sort of brief review of this encounter between Schreiner and Thurman. Again, it is in 1925 when Howard Thurman first hears Olive Schreiner's allegory, The Hunter. And as I said last week, in 1973, so almost 50 years later, Thurman publishes an anthology of Schreiner's writings called A Track to the Water's Edge. And that phrase, A Track to the Water's Edge, comes from one of Schreiner's allegories. Since last week, I have learned that actually Thurman began working on this anthology in the mid-40s. And so this was really a lifelong labor of love for Thurman to publish this Olive Schreiner anthology. So one of the texts that was foundational to our discussion last week and will also play a role in our discussion this week is a piece that was published in 1921 after Olive Schreiner's death called The Dawn of Civilization. It's a very short piece. It was intended to be a book, but Olive Schreiner died before that could happen. And you can access that on our show resources page. And in that piece, which is really devoted to the question of peace and war, Olive Schreiner does make a distinction between different kinds, I should say among different kinds of pacifism or nonviolence. And so here you have in this piece, this distinction made by Schreiner about the different ways by which someone can be opposed to war. And Thurman discusses this distinction, this threefold distinction in the foreword, or actually it's the introduction to his anthology, A Tract to a Water's Edge. So Schreiner in this 1921 piece called The Dawn of Civilization, again, you can access it on our show resources page, says things like, well, you could just sort of inherit your pacifism from a tradition. So perhaps if you're born into the Quaker religion, the Quakers are notorious pacifists, and this is where it comes from. You could be a pacifist insofar as you're opposed to a very specific war, a specific conflict. So you're not necessarily against all war, but just a specific war. That's type number two. And type number three, which really relates to the nonviolent lifestyle or way of life. This opposition to war or pacifism that arises out of the, quote, personal element. So Schreiner doesn't use the phrase lifestyle or way of life, but this like pacifism that arises out of the personal element. And as Thurman understands that, and he discusses this again in his anthology, and you can access that, by the way, on our show resources page. You can access his anthology to Schreiner. It's available online at archive.org. You do have to, you know, check it out, that is, borrow it digitally to see all of it for an extended amount of time. But Thurman, as he unpacks this personal element way of being a pacifist, goes on to say things like one's pacifism can ensue from one's philosophy of life and as part of one's total response to life and one's experience of it. So it's almost like the pacifism emerges out of a philosophical mindset. Another quote, a way of looking out upon the total landscape of life for the garnering of meaning. And he goes on to say that he believes that Schreiner was a pacifist in this sense, that given her whole philosophy of life, it was a no-brainer that she would be against war. And she goes on to say in this Dawn of Civilization that she is a, quote, universal conscientious objector to war, unquote. So she's totally opposed to it because of her outlook on life. And so we started to talk about that outlook a little bit last week. And so we're going to pick up with that this week on this show. And one of the things that we talked about last week was this belief in the unity of nature, that everything is connected. Mankind is a part of nature, and man and mankind are connected to each other. And so to get us back to that discussion, I'm going to play a few clips that speak to this notion of the unity of all things, and then we'll get into the discussion. So the first clip comes from a talk or sermon. It's about 3 minutes long that Howard Thurman gives in 1962, and here comes the clip.
The whole problem of peace, which I want to call your attention, is just fleeting glances. So that is that we are part, man is a part of an encompassing whole. Man is a part of a whole world of nature as well as history. And one of the tricks of the mind, and I use the word trick advisedly, one of the tricks of the mind is to establish for man a sense of his being separate, distinct, and other than the world of nature out of which he comes and in which his life is embedded and by which he is nourished. and the mind and the creative mind of man brooding over the stuff of nature as if it were in essence completely other, until at last he is able to unlock its secrets, and then these secrets become his private possession. And in the exercise of these secrets, in carrying out his dreams and his hopes and his aspirations, he feels under no moral obligation to have any regard for this wider encompassing world of nature out of which he came and from which his secrets come. So that we find him today with a secret in his hand, as if the secret were not a part of the encompassing whole of which he is a part. And because of this secret and the power that it generates, and all of the utilitarian aspects by which the secret manifests itself, the results of the secret become for him, for modern man, an instrument of violence by which he is able, either by threat or by act, to enforce and to implant his will upon other people. And if they will not say yes, the secret will make them say yes.
Again, so that's Howard Thurman speaking in 1962. You can access that entire talk at our show resources page. And so in that clip, which we'll say more about, but just to sort of segue into the next clip, Thurman and the clip that you just listened to is really focused on the connection between man and nature, and that man makes a mistake in thinking that man is other than nature. And this itself leads to violence. And so the emphasis there, although he does talk about committing violence on other men, I interpret that clip as really being focused on the unity of man and nature. The next clip that I'm going to play is from Martin Luther King. This clip comes from the documentary about Howard Thurman called Backs Against the Wall. We don't have the entire documentary on our show resources page, but if you want to purchase it, there's a link to the Amazon page where you can purchase this excellent documentary. So this clip is in that documentary. It's Martin Luther King talking about it. And in this clip, Martin Luther King is really emphasizing the unity of man to man.
Whether we want it that way or not, we all tied together. Every Negro in America is a little white, and every white man in America is a little Negro. The Negro needs the white man to save him from his fears, and the white man needs the Negro to save him from his guilt. We need each other.
So that's a rather short clip. But the next clip, and I'm not sure whether to play this one now, so it's about 8 minutes long. So before I do that, let me just stop and see if any of the co-hosts have anything to say about any of the two clips that I just played.
Yeah, I mean, the first one, there's so much to talk about. I mean, I think it's definitely appropriate to pause there and and really dig into this idea that, you know, this trick of the mind, of this idea of separateness, it's, you know, I want to dive in there because we can point to that as the root of just about every problem, not just violence, in fact, but it's like it's weird because there's a paradox, right? Where the function of the mind is to draw distinctions between things, and the whole concept of a personal identity is housed in the idea that, well, that you're something, and if you're something, then that has to be opposed to something else, at least by the rules of grammar. So the trick of the mind, I like that phrase, because it's really capturing the fact that it's part of the game. It's part of what the mind does. But as we dig into it further, I mean, we can start to see how drawing the distinction between yourself and everything else. It creates the conditions that make various forms of hatred possible. And I don't know, I'm kind of circling around this idea of self-hate, where it's like, okay, well, once you've drawn this subtle distinction between you and other things, then you have an object upon which the emotion can hook onto, right? And you can hook the emotions onto either entity, either the self or the individual separate entity that you're calling self, or this larger thing, which, you know, we might think of as a capital S self. But, you know, I don't think there's a lot of people that go towards a hatred of the greater sense of self without completely leaving, like, call it morality, call it ethics, without completely leaving that stuff behind. Like I think you only go down that road when you're starting to allow evil in voluntarily out of resentment or bitterness. So it's like we can see, I mean, just to stick to, you know, somewhat smaller of a circle, it's like this idea of separateness we could think of in a lot of different spiritual language, but it's like, it's that specific trick of the mind is the form of ignorance that I think most of the spiritual literature is referring to when they talk about ignorance. I think that, like, in Buddhism, like, that it's the ignorance of who you really are as that greater sense of unity with things and the identification with the unity and not the individuality, mm-hmm, that people refer to often as ignorance. So
cool. Yeah. And last week, I believe I mentioned this critique that Olive Schreiner has of Christianity that Howard Thurman discusses numerous times in his talks. And I cannot find where she makes this critique. He says it's in an autobiography, but I haven't been able to find it. But at any rate, Howard Thurman says, Olive Schreiner says, that Christianity is deficient because it draws that distinction between man and animal. And once you do that, exactly as you say, Randy, that forms the basis of othering and hate. And once I do that, the way that Thurman puts it is, there are people that are outside of the circle of, you know, my magnetic, the magnetic circle of my ethical awareness, something like that. I can draw a line and other people are outside of it and they become other. And so indeed that this seems to be a prerequisite for hatred and then violence. And hatred, as we'll go on to discuss in this show, and we mentioned it last time. So one of the things that Howard Thurman is famous for is his framework that is in his 1949 book, The Jesus and the Disinherited, of the hounds of hell, which are fear, hypocrisy, and hatred. And that hatred, we have a very specific duty regarding hatred if it arises in us. We'll get to that in a moment. I just want to flag it now. And so, yes, as we're tracing this belief about unity, and as you put it, Randy, the ignorance of that leads to all sorts of malfunction, if you will, in the person. And that at worst, this matures or devolves into violence. Michael, anything to add?
Yeah, this fundamental, it almost seems that the recognition of the inexorable interconnectedness of humanity with nature is that fundamental piece upon which the fundamental bedrock upon which everything else from it grows. And I know last week I had brought in ancient Greek Stoic philosophy, and this also resonates on that same wavelength as well. I've been currently making my way through Robin Waterfield's annotated edition of Marcus Aurelius's famous Meditations, which is a famous Stoic piece. And in it, he discusses, and I will quote, "It was a Stoic custom followed by Marcus throughout the Meditations to describe the goal of life as living in accord with nature." And Robin goes on to describe that the word nature is intentionally left ambiguous as to whether mean nature at large, aka all the animals and living things that exist out in the world of which we share with them, or human nature in and of itself. And he has this really great line, and I will quote from, he says, Since universal nature is rational, and since the core of one's human nature is rational, living with one's human nature is at the same time living in accord with nature itself. If you observe and understand correctly, nature/nature of humanity dictates the appropriate stepping stones to happiness and virtue." But yeah, recognizing and living in accordance with this idea that humanity is inexorably linked with all of nature around it, and you are a part of that. That is, as it says, it is a key, it is a stepping stone, that is the foundation upon which you can go through and lead a virtuous/happy life in the Stoic sense, and also a life in which you are exhibiting nonviolent tendencies in the public and your private spheres as well.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. And on this show, we have discussed numerous times nuclear weapons. I want to say that in this talk that Thurman gives, he goes on to connect this with nuclear weapons, and that the fact that we have these weapons, which can not only destroy mankind but nature, needs to be dealt with. That all of us have a duty to reckon with that fact of where we are today. I just wanted to throw that in there. There is that connection made. And there's a couple of talks where Thurman does talk about nuclear weapons and the Cold War. Great. So I will then now play this third clip, it's still on these themes that we're talking about. And this clip is actually Thurman reading aloud an allegory of Olive Schreiner. I mentioned this allegory last week. It's called In a Ruined Chapel. It mentions not only the mandate of forgiveness, but also you'll hear at the end this claim made through an allegory that we are basically connected to each other and that we are the kind of same person, if you will. So this clip is a little bit long. It's about 8 minutes long, and it is Howard Thurman reading Olive Schreiner's allegory In a Ruined Chapel.
This is called The Dream in a Ruined Chapel. I heard the breaking of the water on the rocks 300 feet below, and the rustling of the wind among the olive trees and the ruined arches, and then I fell asleep. I had a dream. A man cried up to God, and God sent down an angel to help him. And the angel came back and said, "I cannot help that man." God said, "How is it with him?" And the angel said, "He cries out continually that one has injured him, and he would forgive him, and he cannot." God said, "What have you done for him?" The angel said, "I've done everything. I took him by the hand, and I said, 'Look, when other men speak ill of that man, you speak well of him. Secretly, in ways he shall not know, serve him. If you have anything you value, share it with him. So, serving him, you will at last come to feel possession in him, and you will forgive him.' And he said, 'I will do it.' Afterwards, as I passed by in the dark of night, I heard one crying out, 'I have done all. It helps nothing. My speaking well of him helps me not at all. If I share my heart's blood with him, is the burning within me less? I cannot forgive. I cannot forgive. Oh God, I cannot forgive.' I said to him, 'Look, consider your own past. See from your childhood all smallness, all indirectness that has been yours. Look well at it. And in its light, do you not see every man your brother? Are you so sinless you have the right to hate?' He looked and he said, 'Yes, you're right. I too have failed, and I forgive my fellow. Go, I'm satisfied, I have forgiven.' And he laid him down peacefully and folded his hands on his breast, and I thought it was well with him. But scarcely had my wings rustled and I turned to come up here, when I heard one crying out on earth again, I cannot forgive. I cannot forgive. Oh God, God, I cannot forgive. It is better to die than to hate. I can't do it. And I went and stood outside his door in the dark, and I heard him cry, I have not sinned so. If I have torn my fellow's flesh ever so little, I've kneeled down and kissed the wound with my mouth till it was healed. I have not willed that any soul should be lost through hate of me. If they had but fancied that I wronged them, I've lain down on the ground before them that they might tread on me, and so, seeing my humiliation, forgive and not be lost through hating me. They have not cared that my soul should be lost. They have not willed to save me. They have not tried that I should forgive them. I said to him, be thou content, do not forgive. Forget this soul and its injury. Go on your way. In the next world, perhaps. He cried, go from me. You understand nothing. What is the next world to me? I am lost now, today. I cannot see the sunlight shine. The dust is in my throat. The sand is in my eye. Go from me. You know nothing. Oh, once again before I die, to see that the world is beautiful. Oh, God, God, I cannot live and not love. I cannot live and hate. Oh, God, God. So I left him crying, and I came back up here. And God said, this man's soul must be saved. And I said, how? And God said, go down and save it, you. And the angel said, what more shall I do? Then God bent down and whispered in the angel's ear, and the angel spread out its wings and went down to earth. The angel went down and found the man with the bitter heart and took him by the hand and led him to a certain spot. Now the man wist not where it was the angel would take him, nor what he would show him there. And when they came, the angel shaded the man's eyes with his wing. And when he moved it, the man saw somewhat on the earth before them. For God had given it to that angel to unclothe a human soul, to take from it all those outward attributes of form and color and age and sex, whereby one man is known from among his fellows and is marked off from the rest. And the soul lay bare before them, bare as a man turning his eye inwards beholds himself. They saw its past, its childhood, the tiny life with the dew upon it. They saw its youth when the dew was melting and the creature raised its mouth to drink from a cup too large for it. And they saw how the water spilt. They saw its hopes that were never realized. They saw its hours of intellectual blindness, men call sin. They saw its hours of all radiating insight, which men call righteousness. They saw its hour of strength, when it leaped to its feet crying, I am omnipotent. Its hour of weakness, when it fell to the earth and grasped dust only. They saw what it might have been, but never would be. The man bent forward, and the angel said, what is it? He answered, it is I, it is myself. He went forward as if he would lean his heart against it, but the angel held him back and covered his eyes. Now, God had given power to that angel further to unclothe that soul, to take from it all those outward attributes of time and place and circumstance, whereby the individual life is marked off from the life of the whole. Again, the angel uncovered the man's eyes, and he looked. He saw before him that which in its tiny drop reflects the whole universe. He saw that which marks within itself the step of the furthest star and tells how the crystal grows underground where no eye has seen it, that which is where the germ in the egg stirs, which moves the outstretched fingers of the little newborn babe and keeps the leaves of the trees pointing upwards, which moves where the jellyfish sail alone on the sunny seas, and is where the lichens form on the mountain rocks, And the man looked, and the angel touched him. But the man bowed his head and shuddered. He whispered, "It is God." And the angel recovered the man's eyes now. And when he uncovered them, there was someone walking from them a little way off. For the angel had reclothed the soul and the outward form and vesture, and the man knew who it was. And the angel said, "Do you know him?" And the man said, "Oh, yes, yes, I know him." And he looked at the figure. And the angel said, "Have you forgiven him?" But the man said, "How beautiful my brother is." And the angel looked into the man's eyes, and he shaded his own face with his wing from the light. He laughed softly and went up to God. But the men were together on the earth.
So again, that's Howard Thurman. And that clip comes from a 1963 talk focused on the broader talk is about self-knowledge. And he also mentions this in a talk that he gives on Jesus and the Disinherited, which we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But I'm not sure of the exact date of when Olive Schreiner writes this allegory, but you know, it's sometime in the early 1900s or late 1800s. And so again, it's Howard Thurman reading Olive Schreiner's allegory in a ruined chapel. And I think that that allegory so beautifully captures everything that we've been talking about. And so the angel is able to show the man who cannot forgive the other, show his soul that is no longer, quote, marked off, right? So all of the attributes of time, circumstance, all of the things which individuate one human being from another, that the angel is able to show the man this soul unindividuated. And when he sees it, he says, "That is I myself." And he sees that it is himself and that it is connected to all of nature. And that framework, that frame, if you will, then enables the man to forgive. And so again, you see this recognition in the unity of things, not only man to nature, but man to man, helps one and paves the way for forgiveness. And I think, Randy, you want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this reminds me of something from Lema Bowie's book, Mighty Be Our Powers, where she was describing the impact that forgiveness had on her life. Now, in that story, she was forgiving a person who she had a relationship with in the past and how it caused her all this internal torment. And part of her understanding was that it was like the hatred was hurting her. And, you know, and it's on a different level than the clip, but I think that it's directly related, where, you know, when you have hatred inside of you towards another person, there's this immediate question of, well, who's that hatred really harming most, first of all? And like, the individual who's harboring that, it's like a poison, right? And so it's like there's this direct disservice immediately upon like having such a thing brewing inside of you, which is like one sort of individualistic frame, but addresses the fact that, you know, we have a responsibility to like pay attention and respond appropriately to our environment, because, you know, no matter what the other person does to us, when we start to bring things like hatred and resentment and bitterness into ourselves and have them as whatever they are, justifications or explanations, or, you know, we have these rationalized reasons for holding these emotions, and all they do is make the situation worse. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, this idea of beginning to identify ourselves with the other person or with anything else, it sets up the causal chain for a more peaceful world. Oddly enough, like, it starts all the way inside with the individual making a decision to remedy the poisons, so to speak, that are like, that are just inside. And in that way, you know, of course, there has to be this corresponding recognition that you're not doing this just for you anymore once you start to take care of yourself. So this is now just like this inverted frame on the same conversation, right? It's like, now you have this responsibility to take care of yourself by letting go of hatred towards other people, and hatred towards yourself, and hatred towards the world, and towards God, and whatever else you hate, because it's better for you, and it's better for everyone else, and it's better now, and it's better in the future. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. So there's a couple of different really important insights that need to be had here. And we are going to talk more about hatred. I mean, hatred, the word, I don't remember it being used in this allegory in a ruined chapel. So this person can't forgive. But I mean, one can infer that there's a hatred brewing there. And so there's different ways we can, points of entry, ways of entering the forest, we can talk about the psychic dynamic that's going on here. And so there's a couple of things that need to be recognized. First, like this unity of nature, the unity of oneself to others. And also, as you're pointing out, and this is really driven home by Howard Thurman in Jesus and the Disinherited and in numerous talks that he gives, and we're going to play a very relevant clip to what you're saying, Randy, but in this is the recognition of this unity of myself with everything, but also the recognition that certain emotions are harmful to me. And I think that that's, not everybody recognizes that, right? So there has to be this awakening to the fact that this emotion is bad for me. And that's why Thurman names it as a hound of hell that needs to be dealt with. And we could spend a whole show on Howard Thurman's notion of hatred. He gives several talks just devoted to that topic, and it is a whole chapter in Jesus and the Disinherited. But basically, and I'm no expert, but at this point, I think my understanding is that he basically says hatred, it's destructive, that and it's indiscriminate, that once it gets going in the soul, and this, I think the clip that we're going to play gets at this, it just keeps going, and it really doesn't care about how, like, the cause of it. Like, there could be some rational basis to hatred, but once it comes alive in the soul, it no longer cares about that, and will go on to live regardless of the rational basis for something. So, you know, angry people will be very angry at people for no good reason, this kind of thing. And so this needs to be dealt with. So I'm gonna stop there and just see, Michael, if you have anything to say before I play this next clip.
Yes, I agree. The hatred discussion is one. There's so much to pull from, and to really go into that, that'd be a very fascinating show indeed. But in terms of laboring towards a nonviolent existence for ourselves and for others, this hatred component really has this ability to, as you were saying, Hope, it's very indiscriminate. It's like starting a fire within your soul, thinking you're going to be able to direct it towards your immediate thing that you feel is causing this within yourself, this hatred. But before you know it, the fire is out of control, and it's burning so many other facets of your internal being before the smoke has truly clouded your vision, and you have no, that rational basis that you once had is completely evaporated. It's no longer there. So this ability for hatred to blind and to cause one to draw those distinctions and that otherings between people only further serves the fuel of the fire you light initially to think that it's something that can be directed towards the supposed end that you have in yourself. But no, in the end, it ends up consuming so many other parts of an individual and disillusioning one from their original basis for having that hatred in the first place. Why it's important to then foster those tools and that do the inner work within yourself to go through the process of recognizing the immense interconnectedness and to see others as more like yourself than others to ensure that initial fire is never lit in a response to this external thing that is causing you to have this internal feeling of hatred.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And yeah, it's not me who has that insight that it's indiscriminate. It's Thurman. And I learned that from him. But yeah, so hatred is itself a poison for oneself. And again, Thurman says it's destructive. And because it's destructive, it can't be life. It's not God. It's not vitality, right? And so the trick, the goal, is to make sure that our responses to things that happen to us preserve that kind of vitality and almost like joy. So if joy is not going on, if that kind of like inspirational vitality, there's a clip that we'll play where Howard Thurman uses the phrase, so beautiful, a wild and unrestrained vitality, that if that's not going on, it's like wrong. and hatred, he goes on to say, is absolutely inconsistent with that, that it's destructive. It's not positive and creative. And I think, Randy, you have something to say, and then I'll play this clip. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, this idea of indiscriminate destruction is something I want to dig into briefly. I love that. That's such a... I don't love that. I like the idea. So, like, I was thinking about how one of the things that occurs for me whenever I talk with people about peace, at least at the surface level, at the beginning of the conversation, is there's something along the lines of an argument pressed that, you know, things like war are necessary because destruction is like a means for new growth. It's a change mechanism for society, something like that. And this idea of indiscriminate destruction really, it's like a scalpel levels precision as to why there's a difference between like pruning flowers for the rest of the garden to thrive versus you know, versus like dynamite to dig, right? Mm-hmm. It's like there's this distinction that has to do with utilization of the mind for discernment, right? And the destruction that has discernment with greater good as a motive is like there's like this fundamentally different form of destruction taking place that I just wanted to draw attention to. Is like forgiveness doesn't necessarily connected with this so I know that's how this clip was kind of centered around, but we've been talking about this hatred idea, so I wanted to dig mm-hmm. in there.
Cool. Yeah, so very good. So I think we'll continue on that thread. This is the clip. This is from Jesus and the Disinherited, a talk called titled Jesus and the Disinherited. You can listen to this entire talk. It's superb. I highly recommend listening to this in its entirety. You will learn a lot. It is from 1955, and it's Howard Thurman.
The only thing that hatred knows is to reproduce itself in kind over and over and over and over again. And this leads me then to say, that are part of our great and central responsibility in the living of our lives, if we undertake to live them under the aegis of the gospel of God, we must not only take responsibility for the things that we do, the positive direct act, bottoming the private act, the individual deed with the integrity of the self. We must not only do this, but we also must take responsibility for our reaction to the circumstances, to the events, to the people by whom we are surrounded. I am responsible to God, not only for what I do to you, but I am responsible to God for my reaction to you, for what you do to me. Your life is under a mandate that makes your responses to your environment in accordance with the integrity of your commitment to life. So the exhilaration and the release that comes from being able to express in terms of response to environment a wild and unrestrained vitality. Unchanneled by any moral responsibility that grows out of the sense of responsibility for one's response.
So powerful, so much to talk about in that clip. And you may have detected that I did splice together two different moments. They're both coming from this May 3rd, 1959 talk titled Jesus and the Disinherited. Again, you can listen to that entire talk on our show resources page. So the title of this show is The Responsibility for Our Responses, and that comes from, that phrase comes from this clip. And just to sort of take a step back and remind you that we are really talking about the quote-unquote moral psychology behind the nonviolent way of life. And so we began talking about the belief aspect and that you must believe that, you know, nature is unified and that you are connected to nature, part of nature, and you're connected to other human beings. You're not a separate entity, that this is one of the components of the moral psychology of the nonviolent way of life. And we're getting into this idea of your emotional responses. So again, moral psychology, I like to think of it as, you know, the term that refers to the quote, inner resources, whatever they are, responsible for moral behavior. And so what Thurman is getting at in this clip is that we have a duty to respond to our responses, which are caused by other people. I just think that's extremely profound. I mean, Randy, I will say, I love that. I do love that. I don't merely like it. I do love that idea. And so this goes back to what we were saying, that hatred is, we have a responsibility to respond to hatred in ourself, that if it arises, we have a duty to get rid of it. And how do you do that? We'll go on to talk about that. But again, this is one of the components of the moral psychology of a nonviolent lifestyle, that you have a responsibility to respond to hatred and the other hounds of hell, hypocrisy and fear, in a very specific way. I'll just stop and see if anybody else wants to add.
Well, I can, of course, speak to that. I mean, the SparkNotes version would be, you know, going back to the previous clip that, you know, the response, like the mechanism to uproot these things fundamentally comes down to forgiveness, which is why the angel is trying so hard to bring the person to a state of forgiveness, right? That's like the tool that we use in order to come to terms with ourselves. Now, of course, it's not that simple, but I also want to talk about and just, I guess, tie in the word karma to this conversation. It's a complicated word, but this idea that there's a cause and effect like relationship that exists outside of human relationships, that exists outside of the human mind, that is part of the way things work. And humans have the capacity to perceive and make some set of analysis about cause and effect, but that there's law in the universe. That's the definition of karma that I operate from anyway. And one of the things that seems really useful to at least draw out here is, I know Gandhi said something along the lines of, when you solve violence with violence, you plant the seeds for more violence, or something like that. If you use force to solve a conflict, it's something along those lines. And, you know, the implication there has these connections with this idea that, well, the way you do things makes a difference outside of you. Things ripple outwards. And so when you start to scream at yourself, for example, for not doing something in accordance with your own set of standards, and you're harsh with yourself, there's like this fine line where, you know, you might be going a little too far and kicking the can of hatred just down the road a little bit. So I could talk more there, but I'll stop for now.
Michael?
One thing that really struck me from Thurman's clip was when he was discussing hatred at the very beginning, and he said hatred's one goal is this reproduction, to reproduce its own kind over and over again. And one thing that I was able to draw analogy to was a virus. A virus is sort of this entity which is debated in the realms of biology of whether it is even a living thing. And its one goal is to invade a host, a cell, and then just reproduce more and more of itself until the host is eventually consumed. And then the fuel of hatred or this virus has utterly destroyed the very thing from which it is beginning from. And so then if hatred is similar to this in that it is very indiscriminate and it has this tendency to just reproduce itself in an individual and then to spread itself to others through our own actions being fed and based off of this internal hatred that we are feeling and fueling within ourselves, what represents an antidote or a way in which to combat that? And one way that we've been talking in the last show and in this one is this, having those ideas of the inexorable interconnectedness of all of humanity and to not other those who are around us serve as sort of maybe the Moderna vaccine or the Pfizer vaccine for an individual trying to combat themselves from the virus that is hatred, to sort of put it in the COVID terms we are experiencing. And that ability is to just, because I've been making quite a few connections to Stoic philosophy, to connect it back to that, Stoicism really functions off of this basis of rationality and the consulting reason in which to base your actions off of, sort of in between the impulse and the response. That gap in between is the ability for a reason to dictate what response you will give or what response not to give. And so through having and fostering and going through that inner work within ourselves to bring forth those ideas of interconnectedness and so forth, which will help to combat hatred, our responses will then be rational. And as Thurman had talked about joy, and to go back to my edition of Robin Waterfield's Marcus Aurelius's Meditation, he discusses this process of that there are emotions that we emote due to circumstances which do represent rationality. And then he even says that joy is rational elation, that through this consulting of reason and then our responses through that, that a proper response in consulting reason and not immediately reacting on that visceral emotion of hatred or so forth will produce something rational, which would then in turn be joy. But still a detachment in the sense we are not completely fueling ourselves off of that bad energy of hatred or any other emotions that might hijack the passions.
Mm-hmm. Well put indeed. And I just want to, yeah, this couple of sentences that stick out to me from this clip. Your life is under a mandate that makes your responses to your environment in accordance with the integrity of your commitment to life. So there it is again, that like you're talking about, you know, joy and vitality is used later, that hatred is incompatible with this. And therefore you have a duty to root out the virus, as you're saying, Michael, because that is out of sync with your commitment to life. And again, there's a response to the environment that should be a wild and unrestrained vitality. Please think further about this claim that, you know, you have a duty to take care of what's going on inside of you so that, you know, you unfold in a way that is showing integrity to life. That's the whole goal here. So this is very interesting because when we're talking about moral psychology, I don't really know how to, you know, fit this, okay, we have a duty to respond to emotional responses in a certain way, the responsibility for our responses. And Thurman goes on to say after he makes this claim that the way that you, I don't, he goes on, he's going to say, I don't really know how you do this, but what you have to do is cultivate a desire to forgive. And so I'm going to play that clip. It's not very long. Here it comes. And again, it's from the same talk on Jesus and the Disinherited.
I must somehow develop a desire to desire. To be rid of my hatred and to enter into community. And this is hard. I do not know all of the skilled ways or any of the skilled ways by which the manipulation of a man's insides can bring to pass this new purpose, this new desire. I don't know.
So good. Indeed. We have to be motivated. I mean, I'm just trying to unpack all that's being said here. So, and this bit about you have to cultivate a desire to desire does come after in Thurman's talk when he says, he makes the point, okay, we have a responsibility to respond to hatred in a specific way. And therefore we have to cultivate a desire to desire to forgive and hence get rid of hatred. So I'll just open it up to see if anybody wants to jump in on that claim. We're going to talk about it for a few minutes here.
Yeah, I want to talk about that for sure. And I want to tie it together with the sentence that you were highlighting in the last clip too, because I think that they're directly related through the concept of faith. Hmm. So just, you know, hold desire to desire on the burner. and bring back, you know, your life is under a mandate that makes your responses to your environment in accordance with the integrity of your commitment to life, and hold those two together. It's like you have to have this, you know, Kierkegaard style leap of faith in the form of a belief that all things considered, the universe is good. And if that faith is present, it turns out that there's like this short circuit it's a shortcut to the rational justification for all of the claims we've been making today. And there's a rational, like a completely coherent sound set of arguments that proceed from taking other people and taking yourself and imagining the shared fate. It's like this integrity of your commitment to life idea. It's a promise, right? It's a promise. And now it's a promise that you have to renegotiate all the time. And I think that's where the desire to forgive bit comes in. It's like you have to want the right things. And it's not just forgiveness, although I think that that's kind of critical to the hate conversation. It's a ever renewing commitment to the goodness of being, which provides this foundation for all moral conversations to, you know, come and like actually, you know, work it out in the same space. And if the bottom of that, you know, call it a boxing ring for imagery's sake, you know, if all of the conflicts have to come to the boxing ring that's built on a commitment to the goodness of being, then the arguments all have to go down to a certain place at the end of the day. They all have to lead to a peaceful solution, because otherwise it's working against the original dictates. It's working against all things, yourself included. And so no rational person can start to make decisions based on hate with that kind of faith-based pillar. And the faith has to be this, you know, this, it's the same as this commitment to life, the integrity of your commitment to life. It's that, it seems to be that thing.
Cool. I need to think about. There's a lot there. Thank you for all of that. Michael, do you have anything to add?
Yes, this integrity to the commitment of life is something that also really resonated with me. And for me personally, I drew a connection to one of our favorite individuals on the show, Immanuel Kant, and his morality of when you are doing something that there are the feelings of maybe pleasure or desire we get from doing that particular thing, and then we receive joy from doing it. But the true commitment to this integrity, this true commitment to life and to living and pursuing nonviolent activism and making sure that is fostered within your public and private spheres as well, is that when those passions and desires, that flow, to think of a river and you're the boat and the current is going in the same direction that you are in doing the thing, when the current flows against you, that commitment is really put to the test in that. And it's almost rational in the sense you will continue to pursue it just because it is life. It is so profound. This ideal of interconnectedness and the foundation and foundations from which that springs in a field of laboring towards a nonviolent existence, both in the public and private spheres, that is where it's really tested, because there are so many instances in life where I feel those roadblocks or times in which the currents feel they are flowing against us, and so many things that come up which make us feel that we are disillusioned from this pursuit that we have been striving towards, and that it is in those moments when you really must dig deep, reflect in on the inner world and the work that you've done during those good times to really weather the storms when the external parts are bad, and allow that inner world to be the fuel through which you will maintain and only further your commitment to life in general, and then also towards a nonviolent existence as well.
Mm. Yeah, and this notion of your commitment to life. I just want to focus on that word commitment because as Randy said, you have to keep renegotiating that. That is, you have to keep like returning to the insight that you have this commitment, that this commitment is very, very serious and grave. And I just think that that's a kind of revolution of thought. I know you like that phrase, Michael, and I do too. That commitment to life is something extremely serious, and I'm going to honor that. And honoring that is going to impose on me a very specific way of acting and responding. And so I just want to flag the word commitment there and have us and our listeners just think about the, I don't think in our society we take commitment seriously anymore, that they're sort of, they can be trumped by expediency, right? But this is a sort of like, come what may, you're going to be committed to life. And this desire to desire, again, like trying to unpack that. So you all may know that, you know, in ancient Greek philosophy, there is a distinction made amongst different kinds of desire. And you really get this in Aristotle's philosophy. Plato makes it, but Aristotle makes more distinctions. And so there's a like the desire for the good. That's its own specific desire called boulesis. And then there's the sort of like animalistic desires that we have that arise out of our matter, our body. So food, drink, etc. The sort of, we would call them maybe base desires. Epithumia is the Greek word. And then there are desires that are the result of deliberation about the good, understanding what the good is, and then how do I realize that given my circumstances now? So I have to know what the good is. And I think that goes back to this claim about unity. I have to have that sort of understanding, and I have to understand what I am. And once I understand what I am, then I can look at my circumstances and use my reason to figure out what I need to do. And so there's an impulse for me to do that, but it doesn't arise, quote unquote, from my body, like the way that hunger and thirst does, right? Because if you think about desire is like impulse, but rather like the motion of my body to take action and responsibility to get rid of hate, to work on blame, the things that we've been talking about, like that arises as a result of my thinking about what is good for me, a result of deliberation. And so I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, but it's like proheresis is the Greek word for it. It's a desire caused by deliberation. And I, when he says we have to cultivate a desire to desire, I can't help, and perhaps this is wrong of me, but in any case, it helps me understand it, to say that what Thurman is talking about here is that we have to understand what the good is, and then from that, sculpt our intentions, if you will, so that we move our bodies in ways that move us closer to that good, which would be this commitment to life. Okay, and as we said last time, this is, he says it here in this club, this is hard. And this takes painstaking discipline, okay? But he goes on to say in this clip after this, and we're not going to obviously play the whole talk again. Please, if you're gonna listen to any of these talks, I think probably this is one of the best, the Jesus and the Disinherited from May 13th, 1959. So he goes on to say in that, that first we have to cultivate a desire to desire. So how do we get rid of hate? We have to cultivate a desire to get rid of it. And then we have to bring the person back into the center of our ethical awareness, because when we don't, when we have hatred towards someone, we're othering them and they're outside of our moral sphere. And so we have to like take positive action to bring that person back into our moral universe. So there's like a, it's a two-step. So, or maybe a three-step: responsibility for your responses, number one. Number two, cultivate a desire to desire. And number three, bring that person back into your moral center. Okay, so I'll stop. I think, Randy, you have something to say.
Yeah, I really like the way you framed all that. And what it brought to my mind was the idea of addiction. And it seems like we're addicted to retaliation. We're addicted to like this Lex Talionis frame of reference, or some kind of limited form of justice or whatever, so that we can rationally justify violence or hatred or whatever else. And this desire to desire business, it seems analogous to a person who is in the throes of a substance abuse problem, and they want to get out of it, but for whatever reason they seem like they're stuck in this, you know, relapse loop. And so they go to an AA meeting, for example, and then you have the 12-step program, which has you do a certain set of procedures in order to walk through seeking all kinds of ways to get yourself out of that mess. And we don't have a 12-step program for an addiction to violence or an addiction to retaliation or an addiction to, whatever else we might label this as.
But the trick of the mind.
Yeah, we're back, right? We don't have an addiction 12-step program for the trick of the mind. We don't have that. And instead we have more confusion, all things considered. But yeah, there's this idea that there are maybe prerequisites to forgiveness, which is what I'm reading, or that's how I'm hearing what you were talking about with the distinctions between different kinds of desires from the Greek. This idea that once you've thought about a situation enough, you can see it from this higher place, and you can understand what you need to do from that higher place more clearly. And then you are motivated to start to do things, right? That kind of procedure. What it highlights is that, you know, in order to act in a given situation, you need certain amounts of knowledge. And of course, we know that. But forgiveness is an action. And so perhaps there are prerequisites to certain levels of forgiveness. And if somebody has done a particularly egregious harm to you, the work necessary in order to forgive them often includes fully understanding that person's justifications for that action, fully understanding their motivations. And sometimes those are very, very dark things. And that's where the discipline has to come in, right? Like, you have to put yourself in a situation where you can really put on some dark clothing in order to justify the harm that was done to you. And all of that seems to be a prerequisite to proper or complete or true forgiveness. Mm-hmm. So you have to want to do that whole process, and you have to be willing to go into those dark corners of, you know, the human experience.
Yeah. And it's not the kind of want where, you know, I want hamburger tonight. It's a kind of want that arises out of, okay, this is not good for me. Like, I want to move forward to what is good for me. And then what do I need to do that? And so there may be some, you know, indeed resistance. And this goes back to, the reference to Kant that Michael made, that, it's like difficult for me to swim against the tide, so to speak. But you do that. And what is this? Is that will? Like, what is, I don't know. So this, we get into like different terms of moral psychology, but that's what we're talking about. And I think absolutely, work needs to be done for forgiveness to happen. We have to understand the person's entire context, as you're talking about, Randy. And I also think a lot of work, one needs to really think about blame. We talked about this last time, the notion of blame and how that's contributing to hatred and resentment. That working on that piece, I think, is absolutely essential. And I'm just going to see if Michael has anything to say before I go on to our last clip, because we need to wind it down here. Michael?
I would just add that I think that is a project for us all, to try to find a 12-step program to forgiveness and what groundwork we'd be able to lay for individuals to undergo that process.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's a 12-step program, but people have done a deep dive into this. There's something called the Forgiveness Project, and this is taught to children these days. And yeah, maybe if you're listening to this, you want to seek out, I'm pretty sure it's called the Forgiveness Project. It existed at least about 10 years ago. I'm sure it still does. I believe it may be based in Canada. Anyway, there are programs, and we as adults, of course, need them as well. So what does it look like to do this work? So we're really talking about the interior life, sort of coming to this understanding, taking responsibility for our responses, taking this action to, cultivate a desire to desire. But we're focused on the interior moral psychological aspects. But of course, what does it look like on the outside when someone is doing this? And I would like to play this clip. This comes from a different talk that Howard Thurman gives in 1959. It's called Sources of Tradition. You can listen to it on our show resources page. It's such a beautiful story about his mother-in-law, Mother Bailey. So this is the mother of Howard Thurman's wife, and it's a beautiful story about what it looks like when one is working on the responsibility for one's responses and cultivating these desires. And here's the clip.
A little town in Arkansas, in Dermot, Arkansas, in which Mrs. Thurman's mother lived for many, many years. About 15 or 20 years ago, there was a very mean policeman there. They didn't call him a policeman, they called him a sheriff, which is a more deadly characterization than a policeman. And this was a mean man. Even by standards of that town, he was a mean man. He had killed more than 15 Negroes. One of them was even killed, handcuffed. He was a mean man. And then one day he was taken ill and was in the little hospital in the town. And Mother Bailey went to all of the neighbors and sent other persons who worked with her to all the other neighbors. And every Negro yard in this little town that had any kind of blossoming anything, from a dandelion to a rose, all the blossoms in all the yards were collected. And when the collection was over, they had a wagon load of blossoms of every kind. These blossoms were sent down to the hospital with a note from Mother Bailey saying that these blossoms were collected from the yards of the Negro people in Dermot, and we are sending them to you with the hope that you will have a speedy and effective recovery. And she signed it, Your Negro Friends. Well, 1 week passed, 2 weeks passed, and then the third week came. And when the weekly newspaper came out, there was a little box insert saying, address the, it was signed by the sheriff and addressed to his Negro friends. And his first sentence was, I didn't know that I had any. I appreciate the flowers. The third sentence was, that when I get up, if I do, perhaps I can be one. And then the sequel. Until that man died, and he died in office. After this experience, whenever he saw some young fellows who, from the indications, were about to get into trouble, he would go over and counsel with them and urge them not to do it because he did not want to arrest them. Now, it may not have worked, you see, but back of it was the assumption that the death in this man, the dead place in this man, can somehow be resurrected. And if you can put him in touch with that which will renew him, then the deepest thing in life will call to the deepest thing in him, and he will answer.
So good. Such a beautiful story. And today is the 1 year anniversary of the death of George Floyd. And I think that that story about Mother Bailey and how she responds to the quote, mean sheriff, needs to be considered today. We need to remember this. I'll just open it up to anybody who wants to comment on that story.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to do better than the story itself for like capturing what to do with like a community in distress. But, you know, this theme of love conquers all comes to my mind as a way to move forward. This, like, I was pruning flowers, right? And I mentioned this earlier as an example, but it's like when there's something wrong with the flower, you have to figure out what part of the flower needs to be picked and which part needs to stay. And in the case of the sheriff, I mean, it's like, it's not that there's everything about this person was bad, right? He had some kind of moral failing and that needed to be corrected. And there's a tool for that. And now Mother Bailey seems to have identified what that was and done the perfect thing in order to bring that forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this story occurs within, and the clip kind of gets at it, but Howard Thurman is really talking about this assumption that we have in Christianity, but perhaps other spiritual traditions as well, I would think, that the person, the God is always in the Quakers definitely think this way. God is always in the person, and the person, like Howard Thurman says elsewhere, the person sometimes needs to be shocked, not in a violent way. Sometimes it could be so shocking that there's this act of fellowship, right? It's probably very shocking to the sheriff, like what? And so, because he's not expecting that, he's expecting perhaps hate, right? But this is one way to awaken, as Thurman says, you know, the moral center of the person, which is always there. This is the belief. John Lewis puts it this way: you never give up on anyone, that the thing is always there. You just have to, yeah, sometimes work harder and make yourself vulnerable. And this is the leap of faith, maybe. But yeah, I just wanted to, you know, use that clip because, again, we've been talking about much of the interior aspect of the nonviolent lifestyle. And this story shows what it looks like on the outside. And Michael, you have something to say. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. As you had mentioned earlier, that phrase from the first democratically elected mayor of Hiroshima after the August 1945 atomic bombing, Shinzo Hamai, his phrase in his mayoral declaration, a revolution of thought, that I felt perfectly encapsulated what it is like for an individual to undergo that process when being confronted with something that completely violates what their expectations would have been generally, that he has, the sheriff in the story has forged this reputation of being a mean man, an individual who seems to be very cold, a very hard-hearted individual, so to speak. And so, and in doing that, the responses he would receive, he expects it to be in line with this energy that he emits out into the world. And then so for something, Mother Bailey's actions of collecting all these flowers and then the people presenting it to him completely, like you had said, Hope, shocks the individual. It completely shocks the sheriff. And it is being confronted with something so utterly revolutionary, so to speak, that is what induces this internal revolution of thought and sort of puts him on this new path of, as Mr. Thurman says, of going and consulting these individuals, not wanting to arrest them, like utterly changing every facet of his, what he would normally act from prior. So that's very powerful and just totally speaks as to why that phrase is so amazingly powerful and one that continues to resonate in so many different fields of what we discussed here on the show. It's just, it's absolutely incredible.
Yes, and you may be pleased to know that although Howard Thurman doesn't use the phrase revolution of thought, in one of his talks about nuclear weapons, he does say we need to have a revolution of values. So very similar, but there it is. So yes, I think that, yeah, that's very profound. And as he says, it might not have worked. And last week we were, you know, using some clips, one in particular where Howard Thurman mentions, quote, what is happening in Montgomery and referring to the Freedom Rides, which did not end as planned because there were mobs of white supremacists who attacked the bus with, you know, lead pipes, fire, and so forth. And so you have, you know, practitioners of nonviolence being met with at that moment by violent people. And so there's one episode, I mentioned David Hellerstrom's The Children, if you want to check it out, this story is told in that book, where one person is, you know, sort of like laying on the ground and a white person comes over and says, are you okay? And he says it in that sort of like concerning manner, are you okay? And the person says, yeah, I'm okay. And then the white person proceeds to hit him, you know, with a lead pipe. So it doesn't quote always work in the moment, if you will. And these were the sorts of things that caused the critics of the nonviolent approach to the civil rights movement. And we still have them today. This is still, Randy, you're talking about, you know, some of your colleagues who talk about the necessity of war and maybe the necessity of violence and this kind of thing. And it's very complex. We feel that we need to at least discuss it. It's something that Olive Schreiner, Howard Thurman, Mahatma Gandhi, of course, practiced, and we think that it is our duty to at least look at these ideas. So I think this is a good place to end the show. I will just quickly go around and see if anybody has any last words, and starting with you, Michael, and then Randy, go ahead. Anything? Final thoughts?
Yes. So as we've been discussing for these past two shows now, this very incredible connection of viewing yourself as an individual in harmony with nature. And I was totally reminded of the seven rules of harmony from Cora DeBrazza and rule 5 to be particular, so that is what I will end out with by quoting it directly. So it says, "Treat all birds and beasts and all existences of the animal and vegetable world with justice and gentleness. Do not destroy, save for self-preservation and for the protection of the weak. Instead, make it your object to plant and nourish and to propagate all that will lead to the moral and physical admiration of family and home and the nation." But yes, by leading through the lens of life that you have, leading a life in which you see yourself as inexorably connected with everything else around you, and in adhering to many of the other tenets and axioms that we have discussed on this show, that will help to lead a life in which nonviolence is very possible and can be actualized in both of your public and private spheres. Thank you all.
Cool. Thank you for that. And I would say, yes, that rule of harmony number 5 seems to flow from the quote, to use a phrase that we've talked about earlier, one's commitment to life. I think that that rule that you just read is absolutely connected to the commitment to life. And Randy?
So the general feeling I've had throughout the last 2 shows has been, I guess, a doubling down of the truth of a claim that I learned through William James in his essay, The Will to Believe. And in that essay, he talks about many things that are very significant and relevant to this conversation, but the short and sweet version is faith makes facts. And, you know, a faith in the goodness of being sets the stage for an approach to life that yields a net positive for all beings. It is a prerequisite, in fact. We can talk about how you can be a good person without certain kinds of beliefs in God, for example. It's an atheist conversation, but you need to have a faith in the goodness of being. And once you have it, you can use it as a rational rational foundation for forgiveness, as a rational foundation for taking care of other people, a rational foundation for desiring the right things for yourself, and the rational foundation for trying to make the world a better place in accordance with all the things that are most important based on your own set of standards. But once you have that, this commitment to the betterment of being and a commitment to all of life as part of that, peace is a inevitable conclusion.
Well said. So, and I just again wanted to remind our listeners and ourselves that today is the 1-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd. And shortly after that, our show, which is from June 4th, I believe, I just want to read the title of it. It's Plot, Plan, Strategize, Organize, and Mobilize, which comes from a talk that Killer Mike gave. The rapper, artist, Killer Mike. Plot, plan, strategize, organize, and mobilize the solidarity of human interests and international organization. And so that was, a discussion that we had in the wake of what began to happen after the death of George Floyd. And it's very similar to what we're talking about, what Killer Mike says in this press conference that he gave, was that, you know, we have a responsibility for, he doesn't say this, but it's the same, in the same vein, we have a responsibility to respond in a very specific way to this violence. And that is plot, plan, strategize, a sort of like rational, deliberative response is called for, not necessarily violence and looting. So I will leave it at that. You've been listening to a discussion about Olive Schreiner and Howard Thurman. Howard Thurman encounters Olive Schreiner, and one of the clips that we've listened to, he reads her allegory. So there's so much more there. This is the second of a show in a series We may continue with this, we will see, but you have been listening to Virtues of Peace. Please continue your education by checking out the show resources at virtuesofpeace.com, and have a great evening. Goodbye.